It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Welcome, a very warm welcome to Israel. Your visit here, Mr. President, is truly historic. Never before has the first foreign trip of a President of the United States included a visit to Israel. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for this powerful expression of your friendship to Israel. Mr. President, yesterday in Saudi Arabia, you delivered a forceful speech of clarity and conviction. You called on all nations to drive out terrorists and extremists. You called for the forces of civilization to confront the forces of barbarism. Mr. President, for 69 years, Israel has been doing precisely that. We've manned the front lines of civilizations. We fought terrorism, and we've built a modern, vibrant, democratic Jewish state. In doing so, Mr. President, we've protected all faiths, Muslims, Christians, everyone. Throughout the Middle East, Christian communities are decimated, minorities persecuted. But here in Israel, we're proud to have a growing and thriving Christian community. And we guarantee the rights of all. Mr. President, Israel also shares the commitment to peace that you expressed yesterday. We've already made peace with Egypt and with Jordan, and Israel's hand is extended to peace, in peace, to all our neighbors, including the Palestinians.
All right, that was Benjamin Netanyahu. This morning, if you were up early, you got to see that when President Trump and his wife Melania landed in Tel Aviv. When Benjamin Netanyahu and his wife and the president of Israel and his wife walked along the red carpet to meet them, it really was a kind of an amazing thing. The band played the Star Spangled Banner, and then the Israeli anthem was sung by the men on the tarmac, the soldiers, the president, the prime minister, and their wives. It really was beautiful. And you have to understand, as I know that you do, that this is a momentous occasion, that lives are at stake, that the world is at stake. You know, all eyes are on the Middle East. All eyes are on that part of the world wondering, can these issues be resolved and can we live in peace? Of course, the American press is completely absorbed in our, you know, the feckless or the, let me pick a different word, the alleged collusion of Russia in the Trump campaign. It's just gotten absolutely ridiculous. And what a wonderful break from that kind of numbing drubbing of some story that doesn't even exist. I mean, it was pretty despairing last week, and it's a wonderful thing to see the president and his wife traveling. You should hear the speculation here. Over the last few days, Julie Pace of the AP, who, you know, goes on Fox all the time, and that's so nice. She's just so nice. But she's not so nice. She wrote this piece about Donald Trump and how, you know, basically how was he going to behave on this trip? Because, you see, the word was out that to the Saudis that President Trump, doesn't like different kinds of food. He has to have the kind of food he likes. And one of the things that he really must have is steak with ketchup. So that's Julie Pace reporting for the AP. Of course, the inference of that is that what an idiot. He has to have steak with ketchup, and he can't eat the local food. And, of course, naturally, all of us know that when you travel overseas and you visit other cultures, you try their food. So I don't know if it's true or not true, but this is the thing. These are the things they're focusing on. It is unbelievable. But the president was first stopped at Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and we're going to talk a great deal about that today. But I want to give you just a little bit of a taste of the kinds of things he said in his speech. By the way, it was very presidential. Melania was beautiful, appropriately dressed. She wore nothing over her head, which, by the way, in Saudi Arabia, we even make our soldiers and our diplomats, we make them comply with Saudi rules. So Melania did not. She did not wear her head covered. She looked elegant as she came down from the plane as she went to all the various meetings and functions. So I just think that's a small thing that's not a small thing. But this is what Donald Trump, at least a portion of what he said in his speech. Let's listen.
Will we be indifferent in the presence of evil? Will we protect our citizens from its violent ideology? Will we let its venom spread through our societies? Will we let it destroy the most holy sites on earth? If we do not confront this deadly terror, we know what the future will bring. More suffering, more death, and more despair. But if we act, if we leave this magnificent room unified and determined to do what it takes to destroy the terror that threatens the world, then there is no limit to the great future our citizens will have.
All right, and then to the issue, this was really pretty pointed toward the Saudis. And I think you should listen to what he had to say, to talk to them. He didn't say, we're coming in, we're going to give you lots of money to fight this, we're going to fight this for you. No, he didn't say that at all. This is how he addressed them. Let's listen.
America is prepared to stand with you in pursuit of shared interests and common security. But the nations of the Middle East cannot wait for American power to crush this enemy for them. The nations of the Middle East will have to decide what kind of future they want for themselves, for their country, and frankly, for their families and for their children.
All right, and then he went on to talk about, he called out Iran, which was pretty incredible. I want you to hear this.
Until the Iranian regime is willing to be a partner for peace, all nations of conscience must work together to isolate Iran, deny it funding for terrorism, cannot do it, and pray for the day when the Iranian people have the just and righteous government they so richly deserve.
All right, so that's just a little bit of his speech. We will talk about more about it, and I'm going to play a few more excerpts from it. It actually was an excellent speech, and the thing that I did notice is that the president didn't bend over backwards to paint Islam in a way that's not honest. He was very honest in his words. He did talk about God, but he didn't say we worship the same God. I'm grateful he didn't say that because that's not true. So that's what happened in at least the Saudi part of it. Now, it's complicated. By the way, Iran's response to that was to tell Donald Trump he should be worried about another 9/11 rather than Iran. And of course, they're referring to the fact that so many of the 9/11 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia. And we'll talk about that with Claire Lopez in just a second. When she joins us, it is true that the Saudis have a very checkered past with us in terms of terrorism. So why is it we're reaching out to them, and why is it that they're helping us with terrorism? It's very confusing, but on some level, once we've explained it, it might make some sense, and hopefully Claire can help us clarify that. But in Israel, a couple of things, a little drama is playing out. This past week at the Israeli embassy, the American embassy in Israel, there was quite a dust-up, and it had to do with the president visiting the Western Wall. This is really amazing. By the way, this is a story from, I believe this is from an Israeli press outlet, but it's in English. It's an English outlet. The American official who sniped at his Israeli counterparts at the Western Wall, the holiest place for Jews to pray, is not part of Israel and not Israel's responsibility, was named Tuesday. David Burns, a political counselor at the U.S. consulate at Jerusalem. A second U.S. official, the consulate's economic counselor, Jonathan Schreier, was also involved in the bitter diplomatic incident, which deteriorated into an angry shouting match. So basically what happened, according to a TV report, the angry exchanges began when the Israeli team worked with their American counterparts on preparations for Trump's visit, asked whether Netanyahu could accompany the president when he visited to the Western Wall, a key expected stop on his May 22nd, 23rd visit to Israel and the West Bank. No serving U.S. president has ever visited the Western Wall because U.S. policy has been the final status of Jerusalem has yet to be resolved in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. In other words, it was amazing that Donald Trump said he wanted to visit the Western Wall because it is in dispute. The Israelis took the Western Wall in the 67 war. Of course, the wall, if you've been to Israel, is right at the base of the remains of the temple. It is the holiest place for the Jews, and they wail and worship at that wall on a regular basis. But no American president has ever visited it. So the president planned to do that. But now the American ambassador, David Burns, the political counselor, the U.S. consulate, and Jonathan Schreier, the economic counselor, all say, no, 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 you can't do that. I'll go back to the story here. At this point, the TV reporter said a senior American official rudely responded, "What are you talking about? It's none of your business. It's not even part of your responsibility. It's not your territory. It's part of the West Bank." These comments led to vociferous protests by the Israelis, and the discussion descended into shouting, and the Israelis reminding the U.S. team that the Western Wall and adjacent area is territory holy to Israel. All right, so that's part of it. Benjamin Netanyahu got in touch with others. They said they don't think that's Trump's policy. They think that these people are speaking out of turn. And bottom line, we'll see if the president visits the Wailing Wall. I kind of think he's going to, from what I heard this morning. But it could be that these two employees at the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem might be in trouble. And we hope so. Have we not been saying that there are people in place all over, and that includes in embassies, that includes the State Department, who are not on board with Trump's policy, certainly in Israel? And so that's the abbreviated form of that. Now, I want to tell you a couple of other things. Of course, the Comey thing is heating up. He's going to be testifying right after Memorial Day. And some unbelievable things came out over the past few days about him. Here's a story on CNN just this morning. Comey now believes that Trump was trying to influence him. Well, that's a real shocking headline, isn't it? Since he went to great lengths to talk to us about this meeting that he had took notes where he accuses the president of trying to tell him to stand down on the Michael Flynn case. But here was the real showstopper to me. I mean, this is really an amazing story. It was first printed, I believe, in the New York Times. This is the Washington Examiner. And the fact is that a friend of Comey's who works for the Brookings Institute, Benjamin Witz, went on television to say that Comey hid among the White House curtains to avoid Trump. Let me read it to you. Former FBI Director James Comey now says he tried to hide among the tall blue curtains adorning a White House meeting room in an attempt to hide from President Trump at an Inauguration Day event. By the way, that Inauguration Day event was honoring law enforcement. That's one of the first things the president did. Comey described really not wanting to go to that meeting for the same reason he did not want to go to the private dinner. The FBI director should always be at arm's length for the president. Oh, except President Obama. Maybe not so much, but President Trump. Oh, my goodness. There was an additional sensitivity here, too, because many Democrats blamed Comey for Trump's election, so he didn't want any shows of closeness between the two that might reinforce that perception. He also told me he tried hard to blend into the background and avoid any one-on-one interaction. He was wearing a blue blazer, noticed the curtain was blue, and hoped Trump wouldn't notice him. He got as far as away physically possible from Trump as possible. It's just amazing. Comey took the long walk across the room determined that there would be no hug. It's an amazing story, and I have to tell you, to many FBI agents, an embarrassing one. The FBI director trying to hide in the curtains for the President of the United States at a ceremony honoring law enforcement.
Teresa Burke is a mental health professional who specializes in grief and trauma. Hi, Kim Katola for Cradle My Heart Today. Yet when she reported that 6 of the 8 women in an eating disorders group had had an abortion, her supervisor blocked her efforts to offer them help for that grief. Yet studies show abortion may lead to an increased risk of depression, suicide, drug abuse, and other emotional problems. So Teresa developed the Rachel's Vineyard Retreats, offering the love of Jesus Christ to those hurt by abortion. And now tens of thousands have found help worldwide as spiritual truth heals the many emotional wounds and losses abortion may bring. Teresa says there is help. There is hope. Find out more about Rachel's Vineyard and other recovery options at CradleMyHeart.org. Saving lives and healing hearts after abortion, one story at a time. CradleMyHeart.org.
In Bhutan, where nearly 78% of the population is Buddhist, can the gospel of Jesus Christ make inroads? Hi, I'm Don Shank, director of the Tide Global Radio Ministry, and this is today's Global Update. Bhutan is relatively closed to the gospel and is one of the least evangelized nations. But in 2012, the Tide Ministry began Christian broadcasting in Dzongka, the official language of Bhutan. Please join us in praising God for pastors that are helping to transition curious listeners into committed believers who stand firm in their faith. A pastor who works with the Tide Partner Ministry in Bhutan recently shared this about a new believer. The listener and his wife are Buddhist, but listen to our radio program. Slowly they want to believe in the Lord and are interested in taking baptism. Please uphold them in your prayers. To find out how you can get involved in the Tide radio work and help us share the gospel in Bhutan and around the globe, visit thetide.org. That's thetide.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with this Fox News and Commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
So my name is Atara. I'm a senior and my major is psychology. I love Truett. There may be a lot of other schools out there. You can go to bigger schools. You can go to schools that's way far away from home. But in the end, one of the things that I realized is that God called me here, and that's why Truett is the perfect place for me. And if God called you here, then it's the perfect place for you also.
Are you called? Visit Truett.edu today.
We need to have a national intervention, America. A come-to-Jesus moment. Grown-ups across the fruited plain have gone slap crazy, acting the fool in public. It's as if we've got a generation of Americans behaving like uncivilized Neanderthals. And if you think I'm exaggerating, just head over to the Walmart after midnight. You'll see what I'm talking about. It's like people don't know how to act in public. And that brings me to an incident that happened in my hometown, Memphis, Tennessee. A fight broke out during a high school graduation ceremony over a saved seat, and it was all captured on video. They were cussing and punching all the while the band was playing Pomp and Circumstance. And to make matters even worse, the graduation ceremony was held inside a church. A church! Now that ain't right, America. All that to say, it's time for the grown-ups to grow up. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Interesting story out of Heat Street over the weekend. You know, we talk to Media Research Center all the time because they track how the media covers various things. They've been doing that for a long time. But Harvard has done a study. Harvard, no less. Which, according to the headline, reveals the huge extent of anti-Trump media bias. The academics at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy analyzed coverage from Trump's first 100 days in office across 10 major TV and print outlets. They found that the tone of some outlets was negative in as many as 98% of reports, significantly more hostile than the first 100 days of the three previous administrations. They analyzed CNN, NBC, CBS, Fox News, the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, also the BBC, the UK's Financial Times, and the German public broadcaster ARD. Every outlet was negative more often than positive. Only Fox News, which features some of Trump's most enthusiastic supporters and is often given special access, even came close. But Fox was ranked 52. They only were 52% negative and 48% positive. Isn't that interesting? And that would be an interesting thing for you to read. You might enjoy that article. We'll put that on our Facebook page. And I want to give you just an idea. We'll just play a little bit of this. This was CNN's report on President Trump visiting Saudi Arabia. Let's listen.
Do you see that that chain around, the gold necklace around the President Trump's neck there? Well, Saudi King Salman presented that to the president. It's a gold medal. The collar of Abdulaziz Al Saud is what it's called. And it's the nation's highest honor. I want to ask you, Anuj, what do you make of what is the symbolism there? What is the intention as he gives him that honor? Because already what we are seeing, the grandeur of this welcome is so different from what we've seen with past presidents.
Well, I think that Donald Trump has always kind of taken a softer stance when it's come to Saudi Arabia. You know, they were left off of his famous Muslim ban list and also his executive order barring Muslim immigrants from the U.S. And, you know, despite Saudi Arabia being one of the greatest exporters of radical Islam, Donald Trump has always taken a softer stance on them. And let's not forget, there's a $109 billion arms deal also on the table that he has to seal with the Saudis. And, you know, it's really interesting because in many ways there couldn't be a better time for Donald Trump to kind of be out of Washington and escape the siege-like atmosphere he's facing here back at home and be in Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, this really ambitious trip is full of diplomatic landmines. And I really think his first diplomatic blunder has the potential to start off in Saudi, in Riyadh.
I guess they're hoping for that blunder. I don't think it happened. Actually, I think it was a rousing success, and I've already described that to you. Well, all right, so why is the president in Saudi Arabia, why in the world did he choose that as his first stop on his first foreign trip as president of the United States? Claire Lopez is with us. She is with the Center for Security Policy, and Claire is an expert on all things Islam. She is formerly with the CIA. I always say that. There was a time when I couldn't say that, but I'm saying it now, Claire. You're one of the good guys, and I'm glad that you're able to speak up and use your expertise to help inform us. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Well, thanks for having me, Sandy. Always glad to be back with you.
Hey, Claire, the question was what I just asked. I mean, why in the world do you think that Trump chose Saudi Arabia as his first stop on this first foreign visit?
Well, you know, for those of us who would like to see this president take a stronger and more accurate forthright line about Islam and jihad and Sharia. This was not that speech. This was not that trip. This trip was about telling the world that the United States of America is back. We are back to project power and influence, especially in the Middle East region. And it was about recalibrating the U.S. relationship with the Muslim world. If anything, this speech was a recalibration of U.S. policy vis-a-vis or in recalibration of former President Barack Obama's June 2009 speech in Cairo, Egypt. This was the president telling the collected assembly of 50 heads of state from the Sunni Islamic world. That's 50 out of 57 members of the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation. We have some common interests, but there's going to be some demands with that, too. That's what he was telling them.
Claire, before we get into the weeds about Saudi and Wahhabism and all of that, what do you think the reception, which was full of pomp and circumstance and very warm and welcoming, and it really was beautiful visually in every way, what does that tell us about the Saudis and these 50 state leaders and their response to Donald Trump?
I think that demonstration was, just as you said, was an amazing display of visuals, and the optics were amazing, the staging, the presentation of it all, just an amazing spectacle. But this was a president who has faced down the mob in New Jersey, New York, and other places to build casinos and other facilities, going over there to the assembled, and this is how I think of them, the assembled mob bosses of the Sunni world who came to Riyadh because King Salman of Saudi Arabia said come, and they came to hear What I'm looking at President Trump as the capo de tutti capi, telling them, the assembled mob bosses of the Islamic world, look, you guys are in big trouble. You've got the collapse of oil prices. You've got Iran constructing a Shiite crescent of puppet regimes surrounding the Arabian Peninsula. And you've got the Islamic State, which you've nurtured in your own hearts and in the midst of the Islamic world, and it's now threatening you. All of this threatens us too, we, the United States. We'd like to work with you on that, on all of that, especially Iran. But there's going to be some things, some quid pro quo. And only a guy, I think, like President Donald Trump, could stand up there and face the mob bosses of the Sunni Islamic world and convey that message. And they heard him. Believe me, they heard him.
I mean, I it certainly seems in terms of body language that they did. You know, there was a cartoon, I'm sure you saw it this morning too. I think it was a Saudi cartoon that showed someone bending over and looking at a trash heap, and it said Obama, Saudi policy, Obama, Muslim policy, whatever.
It was Uncle Sam laying a wreath at the tomb of, with the inscription on the tombstone saying, Obama policy, Obama, in other words, Middle East policy. I saw that cartoon too, yeah.
Yeah, so the point is that at least in terms of a cartoonist, and of course we know that media is more controlled in a country like that, that the sentiment is that Obama's policy, even though it's funny, isn't it, that Obama's first trip overseas, his first speech as president was to the Arab world. I mean, and Claire, in succinct form, if it's possible, how would you compare the message of Barack Obama then to the message of Donald Trump now?
Oh, completely different. Now, the beginning of this speech yesterday in Riyadh was full of the diplomatic niceties, and you could almost see, at least I thought I could as I'm reading the text, the cut and paste sections from various of his advisors who are not as knowledgeable about Islam and jihad and Sharia as we might wish they could be. All of that came first. And then there was a pivot point in the speech. When President Trump turned from those opening lines, those opening minutes, and basically starts talking about, we're in this together. The enemy is at your door as well as our door. The enemy being, I mean, he minced words to be sure, and he was talking only about the violent jihad, not the pre-violent or the dawah that concern us most here in the United States. But he talked about having to work together to defeat those forces. And he called it forces of evil versus forces of good. That's how he phrased it. But he was more explicit than any president I've ever heard before when he got to the part about demanding that those nations of the Middle East not wait for American power to crush the enemy. The choice America cannot make for you, he said. He said, You guys, you Sunni nation leaders, your nations must drive out the terrorists, and he calls them extremists. Of course, there's no such thing as extremists, but never mind. We know what he means. Drive them out. And then he says very explicitly, drive them out of your places of worship. That message was not lost on those assembled heads of state. He was saying, this comes out of your mosque, this comes out of your doctrine, drive it out of your communities, drive them out of your holy land, drive them out of this earth, he said. That is more explicit than any president's words I've ever heard.
You know, another thing he said, Claire, that was powerful stuff, terrorists do not worship God, they worship death. I mean, and he's right, but I mean, the interesting thing is that, of course, we know that the Saudis do support terrorism. We know that most of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi Arabians and trained. Osama bin Laden studied Wahhabism out of Saudi Arabia. We know that they fund Wahhabi schools all over the world, and including the United States, which foster terror. So that's confusing to people, Claire. We only have a few minutes left, but how is it we work with them who are proposing terrorism as opposed to Iran who's also propagating terrorism? Where's the hair that we're supposed to see that separates?
Well, here's the thing, and you're absolutely right. At the macro level, it is Darul Islam versus Darul Harb. However, I think this President Trump has made a calculation that the most immediate critical threat is a nuclear-armed Iranian regime that may even have or be developing an EMP, electromagnetic pulse weapon, in collaboration with North Korea. And that critical immediate threat not only threatens the region around it, but the entire world, and is far more dangerous, immediately speaking, than the longer-term threat of pre-violent jihad, civilizational jihad, dawah, for which the Saudis are the key leaders and always have been. That's certainly true. Let me go back to something you said there in the beginning, and that was about what the jihadis think they're doing. They believe that they are devout, faithful Muslims, that their jihad is an act of worship to the one true God, the creator of the world. This is how they think about it, and we have to understand that. They do not worship death at all. They are seeking the same thing that all human beings have ever sought, and that is immortality, because their faith promises them that if they die in the act of jihad, they will have immortal life in paradise with Allah. And not only them, but they can broker in 70 of their closest relatives. And the act of jihad, moreover, in their minds, perpetrates what they hope is the immortality of Islam on earth. They are seeking immortality. It's not death. Death isn't merely a doorway for them. And we have to understand how they think. All that's not going away. But in realpolitik, immediate terms, President Trump has decided to reset the balance in the Middle East, which I would hold was so badly upset from George W. Bush through the Obama presidencies, in favor of Iran, to the point that Iran is now resurgent. It is aggressive. It is geostrategically moving across the entire region, literally surrounding the Arabian Peninsula with puppet regimes, and, of course, driving for that nuclear weapon and maybe an EMP capability. The calculation was that we and the Sunni world, the Sunni mobs, face a more immediate threat from Iran, and we need to join forces, whether willingly or not. I mean, they're not willingly joining forces with the great Satan. Neither, though, is it willing that they're talking to Israel, but they are. And the reason is the dire, immediate, urgent threat from a nuclear-armed Iran.
My guest is Claire Lopez from the Center for Security Policy. And, Jeff, just a programming note here. Let's delay this break by 5 minutes. And, Claire, if you don't mind, we'll go another 5 minutes here because I'd like to ask you a couple of other questions.
Sure.
It is very confusing because we have the cynics before 9/11 have always accused American presidents of being involved with Saudi because of the oil. We got oil from them, and so we gave them a pass on a million things. And now the oil issue is sort of, I don't think, still is the same. It just isn't because of the production we found here through shale and other and fracking. So what is our tie to the Saudis? You know, I remember, one of the Saudi princes had interests in Fox News. I mean, financial interest into Fox News, and there were accusations that it was causing them not to be plain spoken about Islam. We've had a very checkered relationship with the Saudis, and checkered would be the understatement when it comes to 9/11. So this is threading the needle big time, isn't it? I mean, do you think President Trump is declaring them our all-out friends, or is he threading the needle sufficiently?
No. This is the capo de tutti capi. Our president, who knows how to deal with the mob, facing down the mobsters, the collected mob leaders of the Sunni Islamic world, and saying, we have some common interests. We do not believe as you believe. Certainly, everybody now knows that both Saudi Arabia and Iran were deeply involved in the attacks of 9/11. They've never been held to account for it at the governmental level. And as you say, though, Sandy, exactly right, the equation on oil has flipped. The Saudis are no longer in the dominant position they were, let's say, back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, because precisely of American technology and shale oil extraction and fracking and other things. The price of oil has collapsed. The Saudi economy is in trouble, as are the economies of other Gulf states. And so for all of these other reasons, including Iran, the Saudis are in a different position now than ever before in the history of the bilateral relationship going back to the 20th century. And that is why President Trump could go to them and say, look, we know the kind of trouble you're in. You know it. We know it. But we face some of the same enemies, Iran and its proxies, its terror proxies and its puppet regime proxies, and the Islamic State. And so he's saying to them, okay, look, we can find common ground to work on some of these things, but you're going to have to give back, too. There's going to be some quid pro quo, and that is to crack down, at least on the top of the iceberg, as it were, of violent jihad. We're not dealing with pre-violent civilization jihad yet, but we're going to start at the top, and you're going to stop that. Now, this, I think also, I'll add really quickly, has a lot to do with what's going on in the former Syria, the breakup of Syria and what will come next there. The Saudis have tremendous influence in the Sunni Islamic world. Remember, they're the place of what they call the two holy places, Mecca and Medina. Tremendous authority. That King Salman said to the Sunni leadership, come to Riyadh, and they came to listen to our president. So I think it's a significant turning point. Let's see where it goes from here.
Yes, and also within the 2 minutes we have left, what happened when we interceded in Iraq was that we changed the balance. The Shias and the Sunnis hate each other almost as much as they hate us. Although when the chips are down, I'm sure, as you said, they join together to kill us because blood is thicker than water, I guess. But they do hate each other, and we upset the balance, as you have explained to me before, Claire, in the Middle East by allowing Iran to become such a massive power. And then, of course, Barack Obama sending all that cash and money, and the Iran deal gave Iran much more power, which was upsetting the balance. So bottom line, do you think this is restoring the balance at least to some degree?
I do think that's what this is about in large measure. But again, because it is America first, this is in our best interest. It's not just trying to tinker with the balance of power in the Middle East or to reset that balance. That is in our best interest that should be done, because Iran threatens us all with its ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons.
Do you have any concern about the $109 billion arms deal now that was just signed with the Saudis?
It's a huge deal. Now, obviously, we know that this administration and President Trump, he's in Israel today, has repeated his support for Israel. He is going to stand by Israel. They are our number one democratic ally in the Middle East region. They will be what we call the qualitative edge will be kept in favor of Israel. As I understand it, the weapons being sold to the Saudis are primarily for defensive purposes. And again, that gets to the defense against their number one threat, the Iranian regime.
It's all very complicated, but I think we would agree that this was a very smart move and a very successful trip, at least at this point. And now he's in Israel, and we'll talk about that again later. Claire, it's always a pleasure. Claire Lopez with the Center for Security Policy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sandy.
Okay, talk to you soon. All right, Sandy Rios, so we've got a lot more to talk about. There are, of course, domestic attacks going on against the president and against people that he is appointing, like Sheriff David Clark, now under attack from the left. It's pretty amazing. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Corner. A nuclear scientist, born in Italy, now working for our government in D.C., was crowned Miss USA. But she crossed the PC line during the pageant when she was asked whether health care was a privilege or a right. Kara McCullough, Miss USA, clearly and unequivocally said health care was a privilege. Predictably, the leftist keyboard warriors went bonkers. Next thing you know, Miss USA is on TV walking it back. Independent thought is now criminal, punishable by societal condemnation.
Visit the Hamilton Corner on the podcast page at AFR.net for more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Is God calling you to pursue theological graduate education? What's keeping you from taking the first step? Is it time? What if you could choose from flexible class options? Is it money? What if competitively priced seminary offered academic scholarships? Do you think you're alone? What if your classmates were just like you, balancing careers and families with seminary? Hello, I'm Dr. John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Take the first step. Visit wbs.edu.
The political and cultural landscape of our nation will continue to undergo major changes with the shift in power in our nation's capital. All the issues we care about, religious liberty, the sanctity of life and marriage, national security, immigration, and the economy will be up for debate. Focal Point will help you process it all from a biblical perspective live every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 Central on American Family Radio. I'm your congenial, convivial, and amiable host, Brian Fisher, and I approve this message.
In the book of Isaiah, the word tells us the grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God endures forever. In the same way, without careful planning, your financial goals could blow away like the seeds of a dandelion. It's never too early or too late to consider how a charitable gift annuity can help you meet the financial goals you've set for your loved ones, your causes, and yourself. Give AFA Foundation a call at 800-326-4543, extension 345, or visit our website, afafoundation.net. Let us explain how a charitable gift annuity can help you achieve your goals. As we read in Proverbs, the plans of the diligent lead to profit. Our phone number again is 800-326-4543, extension 345, and our website is afafoundation.net.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Donald Trump bet his presidency, and perhaps the future national security of the United States, on what bookies would have to call a long shot, the prospect that Sunni Muslim nations led by Saudi Arabia will help root out and defeat Sharia supremacism. The president called on them to drive out Islamic extremists, whose ideology teaches them to kill and dominate. His audience understood that ideology is Sharia, though, and that they would risk death as apostates for opposing it. The president nonetheless established a test. Join in removing extremists from their mosques, communities, holy land, and out of the earth, or else. It follows that the Saudis, Turks, and others must do the same in the mosques and communities they've established here as well. If President Trump's bet doesn't work out, he must not hesitate to hold Muslim leaders accountable. This is Frank Affney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The author of the memo President Trump used as cover to send his FBI Director James Comey a pink slip defended it today and doubled down on the case against Comey. For the second day in a row, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein visited the U.S. Capitol, and his prepared remarks to House lawmakers described a letter he finished the day of Comey's termination. Quote, I sent my signed memorandum to the Attorney General afternoon on Tuesday, May 9th. I wrote it. I believe it. I stand by it. But Democrats are dismayed by Rosenstein's defense.
He made some very bold statements about his memo and then immediately refused to take questions concerning the memo he just spoke about.
I came out even more assured
that it was absolutely essential that we have this outside independent commission.
Today, we also learned how hard the former FBI director tried to avoid President Trump. A blogger who calls himself a Comey friend describing a January White House meeting to PBS NewsHour like this.
He really wanted to kind of blend in and not be singled out. He's wearing a blue blazer, and he stands in the part of the room that is as far from Trump as it is physically possible to be, and also against blue drapes. He chose that spot because it was, like almost like a chameleon.
But the president did notice the 6'8" tall Comey and called out to him. There's also some new doubt today about widespread reports that Comey was fired for expanding his Russia probe, or that he even wanted to expand it, because nobody remembers him requesting Russia resources. Rosenstein's prepared remarks include this quote: "I am not aware of any such request. Moreover, I consulted my staff and acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, and none of them recalls such a request." Most Republicans were pleased with Rosenstein's visit today.
I think the majority of members of Congress support it.
And some supported one Rosenstein line so much they applauded him.
Basically, he was saying that Russian interference in elections should not necessarily be a criminal issue or certainly not a partisan issue, but an American issue.
And people clapped at that.
They clapped at that. That was a nonpartisan statement, and it got bipartisan support.
All right, that was Peter Doocy's report from last week. I mean, of course, that's what's happening domestically. And James Comey is going to be testifying next week. So it's going to be, you know, more excuses for the press to do what they've been doing. And by the way, someone sent me yesterday a compilation of James Comey's testimony before Congress. He's being grilled by various congressmen, including Trey Gowdy. And it is astonishing. I don't know if any of you sat in front of C-SPAN and watched those hearings. Probably not many of you. I'm stunned to be reminded of the things that happened under FBI Director Comey's watch, the things that he did not do, the granting of immunity to Mrs. Clinton's aides, the ability to retain and destroy their own laptops with information. It is, they go through the whole thing, and it is amazing. And we're going to put that on our Facebook page. It's 40 minutes long. I watched it last night. I could not stop. And I would recommend that you, if you can, put it on while you're doing something else at your computer and just watch it. You are going to be stunned to see, I think, what is, as Comey reveals himself in this, under these, just questions. From Jim Jordan, from Trey Gowdy and others. It's just amazing that he cannot answer these questions. And, of course, his bad decisions or purposeful helping of Hillary Clinton cannot be missed. And so you have to see it. We're going to put it on our Facebook page. And, by the way, of course, I read this to you earlier, but I'm going to drive it home. Here's the headline this morning from CNN. Comey now believes Trump was trying to influence him. Remember what Trump said privately, according to Comey, according to this leak, this call that came into the New York Times, anonymous phone call claiming that James Comey has copious notes and that he has notes of his meeting with Trump, and Trump tried to talk him out of prosecuting General Flynn. And basically it was, as you read the words, according to Comey's alleged note by this anonymous source, General Flynn's a nice guy. Can't you see your way fit to letting this go? That was the coercion that Comey is. Of course, he was trying to influence him. I don't think that's. I'm sure that that's true. That's not a headline. And the fact that Comey hid among the White House curtains because he didn't want to be seen with President Trump just shows you that he had no business for 30 seconds being the FBI director under President Donald Trump. The mistake here is that Donald Trump did not fire him immediately. Of course, if he had, the press would have been on him sooner, doing what they've been doing this week. It's an amazing story. And of course, now we have Bob Mueller, who is now the special counsel, looking into Comey's handling of this and the alleged Russian influence in our election. And of course, Mr. Mueller is very close friends with Mr. Comey. And of course, we're hearing about how much integrity Mr. Mueller has. And I told you last week, and I will tell you again, it was under Mr. Mueller that the FBI first began to lose its reputation. It was Mr. Mueller who failed to send FBI agents in to do what they're supposed to do, and that is investigate Benghazi and what happened. It was days before any kind of FBI even showed up. You could see the press, reporters were walking through the evidence. You could see blood, you know, bloody handprints on doorposts, but the FBI just couldn't make it there. Just, you know, not until after the evidence had been lifted, taken. We heard from reporters the things that they were finding. They were reading to us stuff they were finding in the embassy, but the FBI held up their investigation. And of course, oops, they didn't really find anything. That was under FBI Director Mueller. And I can tell you again, that was a complete embarrassment for serious FBI agents because people are scratching their heads saying, what in the world is going on here? It was under FBI Director Mueller that the manuals were scrubbed at Quantico, that all of the training FBI agents on the issues of Islam and radical Islam and Sharia law were scrubbed. It was under FBI Director Mueller that the SPLC became the go-to group that they used on their website that, you know, helped them identify hate groups because, you know, the SPLC is so trustworthy. It was under FBI Director Mueller. Now, he's the trustworthy man. They want to tell us how trustworthy he is and how objective he will be as he looks at what his friend and former colleague James Comey did with the FBI. Really? Really? So that's what's happening. But there's more. Oh, but wait, there's more. Where to go from this? Because I have several things I want to make sure I get in here. Maybe I'll come back to this on another day, but I just want you to know that Sheriff David Clark has been appointed to a high position at Homeland Security, and I guess many of us would say it's about time, because we knew that Sheriff Clark had made it clear that he wanted to work with the Trump administration. Remember how he campaigned for Donald Trump, and yet he was prevented by, I wonder who, shall we say, the Never Trumpers, who are the ones who are now, choosing staff for the president, who are doing so well, aren't they? They're serving him well, are they not? So Sheriff David Clark has finally got a position, at least he's in the process here, and now the left is unleashing on him. This is one article. This is by Juliette Kamen. Julia Kamen, a former assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. She writes, if controversial Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark is correct, he's being tapped for a senior role at the Department of Homeland Security. Although DHS hasn't yet confirmed it, in a radio interview Wednesday, Clark said he was honored and humbled to be appointed. But he said to the office, she said, reportedly as assistant secretary in the Office of Partnership and Engagement. And then she says, that's my old job. I've never met Clark, but based on his inflammatory rhetoric along with a cloud hanging over his tenure in Milwaukee, I'll just come right out and say it. He's not fit to serve at the agency tasked with domestic security for all Americans. But she was, of course. And as I recall, it was the Homeland, under the Department of Homeland Security, led by Jay Johnson, and of course by Juliette Kamen, now we know, who allowed more freedom from MS-13 for illegal immigrants and for the Muslim Brotherhood. Man, oh man, what a record. We surely wouldn't want Sheriff David Clark in there doing what she was doing. How could he possibly be so competent? And now they're accusing him of plagiarism on his thesis at the Naval Postgraduate School. And if you read the article, it's because he didn't use quotes. He gave attribution, but he forgot quotation marks in certain areas. It is an amazing thing, so watch for that today. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.